All right. Hello. So for those of you who haven't met me, my name is Iva Nastyovich. I'm a grad student with Michael Desai. And basically, unlike most of the talks that we've been hearing over the past couple of weeks while I have been here, this will be primarily a theory talk. And you know, there isn't any sort of inference or application to data directly in mind over the course of this talk. And basically, the idea is more to think about sort of a classical model of negative selection and to try to understand it better, both qualitatively and quantitatively. So sort of the empirical motivation, okay, yeah. So this is, before I forget to acknowledge people, this is a project that I've done in collaboration with Ben, who's sitting here in the audience, and my advisor, Michael. Okay, so negative selection is an important evolutionary force that on some level has to be acting in all populations. You know, negative selection is what we think of as being responsible for the conservation of sequences at functionally important sites at long evolutionary timescales. On shorter evolutionary timescale, it is thought to play a major role in shaping patterns of between species divergence, for example. So, for example, negative selection has been hypothesized to explain a large proportion, a large proportion of the human-chimpanzee variation in divergence along the autosomes. And it's also proposed to play an important role alongside positive selection in shaping pairwise patterns of pairwise diversity in Drosophila.
So, excuse me, can you quickly say what you mean by negative selection?
I mean sort of the selection against new deleterious mutations. So you have the idea is you have a well-adapted population in an environment where it has been evolving for a while and it has evolved some function. And basically there are deleterious mutations that lower individuals' fitness in that population. And so negative selection is selection against these new deleterious mutations. All right.
So but, how does it explain its divergence?
I'll get to that in a little bit. But I guess the point that I want to make is, you know, at this point, there's a substantial amount of empirical data that has used previous models of negative selection, claiming, you know, actually this is something that seems to be empirically relevant on both very long and very short evolutionary timescales. But for something as basic as this, I guess the argument that I would like to make in the next few slides is that we actually have a very poor quantitative understanding of negative selection. And so something that I would like to highlight at this point is, you know, this study over here was published in 2009. This was a few years after the publication of the first chimp genome. And so at that point, what they had was this one, you know, with this one chimp genome that they could compare to human genome available at the time and look at divergence, right? So they had a sample of exactly two. This study was a resequencing study of the Drosophila DGRP lines that was published last year. And, you know, they had actually many more than two individuals over here. And yet, all of the statistics that we're really theoretically able to understand and look at are these, like, average pairwise statistics. And I guess the argument that I would like to make is we really need to move beyond that. Okay, but to get back to Michael's question, you know, how does negative selection shape divergence along such large genomic scales? Well, on a very basic level, we do understand how it does that. It reduces diversity. It reduces diversity at both directly selected sites, but also at linked neutral sites. And so the idea is, you know, imagine that you go out into, you have some population of individuals, and you look at that population at some genomic locus. And so what you will see is that, and the majority of the sites, individuals in your sample have the same sequence, but there are also some polymorphisms indicated by these yellow dots. And I use yellow to indicate neutral polymorphisms that are tolerated well. They don't change the fitness of the organism. But basically, alongside these neutral polymorphisms in gene-rich regions, you will have deleterious mutations occur. at sites that are where they're not tolerated. And because they destroy some function, basically selection will act to quickly remove these haplotypes from the population, and in doing so, it removes not only these deleterious mutations, but any closely linked neutral mutations before recombination can move them to a different background. And so the idea is that sort of in the long run, basically only individuals that do not get any of these deleterious mutations can have descendants in the populations. And so because these, you know, deleterious mutation-free individuals should be, in the absence of positive selection, they should all be selectively neutral, basically the idea is that diversity should look like that of a neutral population, but with a reduced effective size. You know, the effective number of individuals that is contributing to the population is smaller, and so this reduces total diversity. Okay, so what do I mean it should look like that of a neutral population? So a statistic that people often use to quantify, you know, looks like a neutral population, or to quantify diversity is the site frequency spectrum. So all that the site frequency spectrum is, you know, you take all the polymorphisms in your sample and you measure their frequencies and you calculate or you plot a distribution of polymorphic frequencies in the sample. And so neutral theory gives you a prediction for what this distribution should look like. And sort of a prediction of the verbal argument that I just gave you is that, you know, in the presence of negative selection, this should just look neutral, but with a reduced effective population size. Just, it should be proportionally smaller. And so you can go out, you know, we can let's test this in the simplest possible way. Let's run an explicit simulation where you have, you know, nothing too exotic going on. So you have a population of fixed size, and everything that's happening in this population is you're getting neutral mutations and you're getting deleterious mutations at some rate. And so let's look at how this distribution of neutral polymorphisms look, and you get something that looks very non-neutral. So at these intermediate regimes, it sort of agrees with this reduce any picture, but then, you know, there's this enormous excess of rare variants compared to this and reduced any prediction. There's enormous excess of high frequency variants compared to this prediction, and we simply do not have any analytical or models that can capture this right at this point.
So, is it intuitive why this happens?
That is the subject of this talk. So basically, my goal for this talk is, you know, we have analyzed this model in a slightly different way, and I hope to paint an intuitive picture for, you know, what the origins of these distortions are. Okay, I mean, so sort of from a practical point of view, this is, understanding these distortions is really important because, you know, this excess of rare variants is usually taken to be a signature of a population undergoing rapid expansion, and this type of non-monotonicity actually emerges in frequency spectra of positively selected beneficial mutations. And so basically disentangling these types of signatures within the site frequency spectra from these, you could argue, more interesting events than negative selection is really important. Now, what I would like to emphasize is, you know, because you have an excess of both very rare and very common variants, this is sort of a fundamentally sample size dependent effect. And so here, you know, so for example, any statistic that is based on the site frequency spectrum that would be sensitive to the sample size, so for example, the average minor allele frequency of the polymorphisms in the sample should be affected by this increasingly at larger samples. And so what I have over here is basically just the average minor allele frequency for the data shown in the plot before. The black line is the neutral prediction, and the purple line is sort of the simulated data. And what you can see is that at very small samples, it sort of agrees with neutrality. But as you increase the size of your sample, you can get orders of magnitude of big deviations.
Is this sexual or asexual?
It's asexual. Okay, and so And so, you know, this sample size issue is, you know, you can sort of think of the sample size as sort of being a parameter of your model in a pretty dramatic way. And what it means is that, you know, these distortions, when you look at a small sample of individuals and you look at average values of these statistics, you might not see any difference between negative selection. But then these distortions that you are going to be increasingly able to see in these larger and larger samples that we have today are only seen in these big samples. So traditionally, backward in time approaches based on the coalescent have been used to predict diversity. But, you know, there are fundamental problems based on these genealogical approaches. So first of all, you know, in the presence of a selection, they are essentially numerical methods. So they give you no idea about how these distortions should scale as your selection strength increases or your mutation rate increases. And secondly, and sort of a more technical challenge is that actually they start performing pretty poorly in samples of large size. And then finally, you know, in the case of background selection, this effect does end up depending on the sample sizes we have seen, so you basically can't just extrapolate. And sort of analytical calculations based on these backwards in time approaches are able to give you predictions, you know, for two or three individuals, but essentially it's they quickly become analytically unwieldy and you can't push them to larger samples. Okay. So we have thought to take a sort of different approach. And, you know, the tricky thing over here is that, you know, you have your sample of individuals and then you have your model. And the way you generate these predictions is you go and try to enumerate all the possible genealogies that are consistent with this model, and this gets quickly unwieldy. But if we're interested in statistics like the site frequency spectrum, you know, the genealogy is really quite an overkill. And so instead, you know, if our observable is the allele frequency, then that observable has a very simple non-genealogical interpretation. So when you see an allele at some frequency f, at some point in time, what that, you know, that SNP has some sort of trajectory over here. You know, this is, say, a selective sweep in over time. And so, if all of the SNPs in your sample were sweeping, then basically the probability that you see a SNP at some frequency should just be proportional to the amount of time that an average trajectory spends at that frequency. And so, your average expected site frequency spectrum should just be like the inverse of the amount of time that a typical mutation spends over there. And so, you know, in the case of a selective sweep, what will happen is, you know, at 50%, that's when they move the fastest, and so that's when you expect to see the fewest polymorphisms, but at, you know, close to zero and close to one, you 100% you expect to see proportionally more. And so, for example, you know, this is why selective sweeps sort of can give you these non-monotonic site frequency spectra. So to come back to background selection, really, you know, to study this, we want to define sort of the simplest possible model. It will quickly get complicated, so we start, you know, from an asexual genomic segment, no recombination happening within the segment. Okay, so, you know, we imagine a population of fixed size n, in which mutations occur at some rate u, and they all have the same deleterious effect on fitness s. So in this type of population, you can classify individuals according to the number of deleterious mutations that they carry. So, you know, of course, you will have the wild-type individuals. At this segment, they carry no deleterious mutations, and, you know, selection will try to maintain these individuals. Now, deleterious mutation will cause deleterious mutations to occur on this wild type background, and basically that will create individuals of lower fitness in the population. But basically, as long as they're created at a rate that is smaller than, you know, selection can that is smaller than the time that it takes for the rate at which selection removes them, basically, you know, in this case, the majority of your population will remain wild type, and the selection will be efficient, and sort of diversity and mutational trajectories will be unaffected. But however, in the opposite case, when mutations are created at a faster rate than selection can purge them, you end up having this broad distribution of fitnesses at the genomic locus in the population. And so in this case, negative selection leaves a strong signal in diversity, and this is the case that I'll be focusing on now.
Would you mind quickly saying how exactly you model, generations, like in terms of fitness?
So what we assume is sort of a simple Wright-Fisher model in which I will put up some equations later, basically describing the exact stochastic process, but basically, so every generation, you have a death rate of one, and each individual is resampled with probability e to the s, or e to its fitness. So these individuals are resampled at a probability that is much higher than the mean. And so, in a sense, they appear, because they're higher fitness than the mean, they will appear positively selected in short time scales.
So basically everybody dies and then you fill all the slots.
Yes, exactly. So what's really important to explain is that, we're focusing on the case of strong selection, in which essentially all of these individuals, even though they're the majority of the distribution, they're so strongly selected that, selection will eventually remove all of them from the population. So what you have is really, these guys, yeah, exactly. These guys are reproducing at a faster rate than everyone else, and basically, so you have a constant turnover of these deleterious individuals that are being replaced by new mutations from the wild type individuals.
And then you also have neutral mutations.
That's right. You have neutral mutations. Okay. So what do trajectories of neutral mutations look like in this model? Okay. So, let's imagine a neutral mutation that occurs on the background of an individual that has no deleterious mutations at that site. So this mutation, all that it does is it colors the individual purple. It has no effect on fitness. And so, okay, so let's think about what happens in these to this mutation. So originally, once it very soon after it arises, it will be, approximately clonal. But and most of the time, like most neutral mutations, they will go extinct shortly after arising. But if they don't, then deleterious, because this purple individual is no different than the wild type, deleterious mutations can also occur on their backgrounds. And so when a deleterious mutation occurs on this purple background, then you end up having a purple individual in one of the classes of lower fitness. And so what I'll be tracking over here is, let's think about how the number of individuals divided by n of these purple mutations changes in this founding class, and how the overall number of purple individuals changes. And so, this is what this plot is going to be showing as a function of time. What is this red frequency, and what is the frequency of all of the purple individuals summed? Okay, and so basically, these trajectories have three phases. So, in the earliest phase of the trajectory, this purple mutation, if it doesn't go extinct, it will tend to approach mutation selection balance of its own. And so, what we will see is sort of this rapid spreading of this purple mutation through the fitness distribution. And so very shortly after arising, sort of the total allele will be much larger than the number of truly neutral individuals carrying that deleterious mutation, But unlike the whole population, which is at a very large size and stabilized by selection, basically this purple lineage never truly approaches stable mutation selection balance. What happens, you can imagine what happens if the number of purple individuals fluctuates in this class over here. Well, what happens next is a larger number of their purple descendants are generated, and so the total allele follows. And similarly, if it fluctuates down, these guys are continuously purged, and fewer of them are going to be reseeded, and so the total allele frequency fluctuates down. And so, basically, in this next phase of the trajectory, the total allele frequency is following what happens among the most fit individuals that carry this mutation. And then finally, one of two things must happen: either this purple a mutation fixes in the founding class, in which case it has to fix in the whole population, or it goes extinct, as it did in this simulation. And so in this case, it just has to go extinct in the whole population.
But what I don't quite understand is, why is the frequency in the founding class different from the overall frequency? I mean, shouldn't it be?
So this, you can think of it as, you know, I just want to. So this the number of mutation-free individuals overall, the blue ones, is much smaller than the total population.
Right.
Similarly, the total number of, you know, any labeled lineage is going to be smaller than the overall population.
Well, I'm just thinking that let's say half of the founding class is purple, for argument's sake. Wouldn't you expect half of all the mutation selection balance, half of all the other ones also be purple?
So if half of the founding class is purple, then what you would expect is, you know, that, you know, this is a small proportion. So this small proportion, say H naught, that the founding class is, times one half should be the frequency of the mutation in the founding class.
Like, when you say frequency in the founding class, you mean the frequency within the bigger population of the guys that are in
there. So what I specifically mean is, you know, this, okay. So the total allele frequency F at some time T is, you know, the sum over all classes times Fi of T. And what I'm showing on the graph is, you know, the red line is F naught and the purple line is F. And so this one is strictly larger than that one.
If you normalize by the size of the zero class, then it would be a half.
Yeah.
Right. Just a question of what's in the denominator.
Once they're large enough, it would be a half. Okay. But,
So for this mirroring going on, do you have to, are there constraints on time scales?
Yes.
Or on population size in the founding class?
Yes, precisely. Actually, that's my next point. And so, you know, so first of all, you know, this mirroring, it takes some time for these deleterious mutations to accumulate and for the lineage to spread through the distribution. So, for, you know, first of all, there's some time delay between these peaks. But secondly, there is some amount of smoothing in the system, and the idea is the individuals that are present at this time point in the population, They're descending from both these and these individuals, because once they spread out, there's a finite amount of time that it takes until they are removed from the population. And this actually dramatically alters the statistics of the trajectories. But sort of a key feature is that you know, fluctuations of the lineage are essentially driven primarily by the most fit individuals, and basically you can think of the remainder of the population, because it's so much, because they're generated at such a high rate, you can think of them as sort of displaying effectively deterministic dynamics, where they, you know, they with some time delay and some smoothing, they mimic what happened in the founding class. And so the way you model this quantitatively is, you know, when selection is strong, essentially all of the interesting behavior happens at relatively low frequencies. And so in this case, you can model the allele frequency trajectory sort of as a coupled branching process. You need, because different individuals with different numbers of deleterious mutations within the lineage feel different amounts of selection, you need a separate branching process for each of the fitness classes. But then you have, they're coupled because, you know, deleterious mutations moves individual from one class to another, and then you also have to appropriately model drift in this case. But basically sort of using this intuition that selection is most important in the top class, you can actually show that this term is asymptotically small in all, but it's the top few, but, you know, for all of the important large trajectories, it's usually only one class that it is important in. And this,
just to make sure I understand, so when selection is strong, you still need U to be bigger than S.
That's right.
So you need large population.
You need a large population.
And that true.
Yeah. In the opposite limit, you know, the population ratchets on a timescale that is comparable to the timescale in which a common ancestor is determined. So this is sort of a case that has been studied by others. Okay, but you know this type of model essentially ends up. Oh, I'm so sorry. It admits a solution.
Sorry, one more question. So you said the stochastic term is only relevant for the first classes, mm-hmm. right? And the argument is because n is small.
The argument is because
n is small there.
The argument is actually because this U is large. So once you, you're in this limit where once you start generating a large number once the size in your class ends up being in the founding class ends up being large enough, you are generating so many deleterious individuals that basically in the next class, they're being generated at such a high rate that in the next class, they are primarily influenced by drift and selection. By mutation and selection, and their drifts ends up, you know, their fluctuations use drift ends up having a very small effect compared to the strength of selection. And
so it's relatively small compared to the other.
Yes, relatively small compared to these terms, and these terms you can sort of describe deterministically. And so you can write down a formal solution for the total frequency trajectory in terms of you know, say in this case, say the zero, the founding class.
So but, and total is again that sum.
Yes, total is again that sum.
So I still don't quite understand that sum, because just taking the sum of frequencies doesn't really, what does that mean? Shouldn't you like weigh the frequency by the importance of that class?
Yeah, so I've subsumed that weight within the.
So that's, yeah. so it's basically, so if you were, is a weighted frequency.
Yeah. Yeah.
In that class,
that's
times
right.
The importance of that class. It,
no, actually the opposite. So in this case, you know, say that the total size of this class, it ends up being, you know, it's e to the minus, can you see this? It's e to the minus lambda. And if it is at 50%, then F naught is 0.5 times e to the minus lambda.
Yeah, so e to the minus lambda is the fraction of this class in the whole population.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So this is a weighted, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And that's this way, that's F total is that thing.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so, you know, so this over here is sort of a standard single locus trajectory. But because it appears inside this integral, where this function has a peak and it has a finite weight, basically this is not a standard single locus trajectory. You know, this trajectory is correlated in time, and basically when these correlations in time are shorter than the width of this, it ends up, you know, the statistics of this trajectory are not the same as the statistics of this trajectory. And so calculating this time integral is sort of something that you have to be a little bit careful about, but it's doable. And so once you do, you can fully characterize the distribution of trajectories. And from this distribution of trajectories, you can basically calculate any single locus statistic. And in this case, you know, we were interested in the site frequency spectrum, so this is what we were gonna do. And so what this gives you is predictions for the form of the site frequency spectrum in all of these regimes. So for example, you know, we can calculate that that in this low frequency regime, it scales as this 1 over s squared root log ns e to the minus u over sf. And over here, there's this different functional form. And we can also calculate the transitions where basically these behaviors switch over. And so, you know, this frequency over here is actually equal to 1 over nes. This is what you would think of as you know being the limit where neutral mutation where deleterious mutations can reach in this population, except that intuition ends up being sort of totally wrong, and there's a more subtle reason for why that frequency is over there, and we can talk about that later.
I'm sorry, I should have seen this already, but what's the role of linkage in sex in this?
Is this it's all fully linked. There's no.
That's right.
There's no sex.
So you're calling this background selection, but it's formally equivalent to Muller's ratchet then?
No. I'm calling it background selection, but it's formally equivalent to. No Muller's. Sorry. So this is in a parameter regime where it's so strong that basically all deleterious mutations are removed from the population on a long enough time scale. So the population is not ratcheting, and yet you see these sorts of effects. And so sort of up to these logarithmic factors, this looks like the Luria-Delbruck distribution. So even if you look at the functional form, this looks exactly like what you would get if the population was expanding exponentially. And again, this 1 over 1 minus f, it sort of looks like a selective sweep for a reason that I will, I will explain in a few slides. Okay, so, at this point, we've used this description of allele frequency trajectories to calculate the site frequency spectrum, but, we really have more than that. Because we have the trajectories of any mutation, all the possible trajectories of mutations that reach any frequency, we can sort of go back and relate these trajectories these allele frequencies to sort of their both past and their future. Okay. And so, there are several conclusions that sort of emerge from this quite directly. So, previously what I considered is the mutation arising in the zero class. And so that mutation in our previous simulation it went extinct. In this case it can also fix simply by drifting to fixation in this class. And so descendants of individuals that mutations that originated in the zero class are basically can be seen throughout the site frequency spectrum. Similarly, mutations that arise in the background with one deleterious mutation can still spread to quite high frequencies, and they can never fix because they start with deleterious loads, but they're able to reach a finite, limited frequency in the population. Similarly, individuals that arise in a mutation. Mutations that arise in an individual in the 2 class can also reach an even more limited frequency in the population. This goes all the way down to lowest frequencies, where basically, independent of how many mutations you have, you can still drift around for a little while before selection removes you. And so what you're seeing is that basically, as you go to lower and lower frequencies, there's an increasing number of individuals that contribute to the allele frequency spectrum, and so it's not surprising that this leads to this increase in the allele frequency spectrum. However, because we have sort of quantified where these transitions happen, what you can also say is, when you see a mutation at 50%, that back in time, when it arose in an individual that was one of the most fit individuals in the populations back in the time. And then similarly, ancestors of these individuals had no more than one deleterious mutation at that locus. And they're actually more likely to have one than zero because there's more individuals in the one class than in the zero class.
Have you modeled these neutral mutations? Are they just one of a finite set, or are they? Because if you get the same one in these other classes, they can't be continuous, for example. Otherwise, they would all be different. So this purple one, if it arises in the class like minus 3s, it's the same purple one.
It's just the distribution of allele frequencies of all the you forget about the identity of the mutations, you just record its frequency. That answer your question?
Well,
mutation is different.
Sorry? Every mutation is different. Right?
Yeah, no.
Every mutation is different.
Yeah. But it, you know, because you have the full, you know, you have the full probability distribution of, you know, the whole allele frequency trajectory. So, you know, if you condition the observation frequency being at 50%, you can sort of trace it back in time and see basically which trajectories this is consistent with. And so that's all that's happening over here. And, you know, over here, no trajectories, basically, you know, the probability of reaching 50% is zero, or, you know, very close to zero. Is exponentially small if you originated in a mutation with in an individual with one deleterious mutation, and so you know that these mutations arose in the most fit class. Okay. And so, you know, this sort of brings us to this region of quasi-neutrality, and you know what these in this case, basically, for a mutation to be at this high a frequency, it could only originate in the zero class and basically reach this sort of transient mutation selection balance. And so because fluctuations in the allele frequency at these frequencies correspond to sort of slow fluctuations in the founding class, basically, as a result, they sort of have emergent neutral statistics. You know, there, and at no point in the population does the population have to be sort of in detailed mutation selection balance, but because these fluctuations are slower than the time scale in which these deleterious mutations turn over, they basically accurately reproduce these statistics. And so this explains this sort of regime of quasi-neutrality. And so when you see a mutation at this frequency, you know, you know something about their fitness distribution too. You know that they should basically be present in backgrounds of all fitnesses. And then finally, this brings us to this last non-monotonic region of the site frequency spectrum. And sort of what happens here, what you can show is that these frequencies essentially correspond to frequencies where the mutation has already fixed in the mutation free class. And if it fixes in the mutation free class, then basically, you know, essentially all individuals that do not carry it also have some deleterious mutation. And so even though this mutation has no effect of no direct effect on fitness, now because of what it's linked to, it's positively selected. And so what this gives rise to is this sort of sweep-like signature. And this is, it's, if you think about it, it's not like a normal selective sweep, because as it's fixing in classes of higher fitness progressively. And so, in a staggered way, and so as it's fixing, basically it's losing, the average fitness of the mutation is going down. And so this is what gives rise to this logarithmic correction. Okay. And so if you observe a mutation at this frequency, you know that it's in the process of sweeping through the population, and you know that ultimately it will replace the ancestral allele at that site. And so, in conclusion, basically what we found is that background selection can cause dramatic distortions in the site frequency spectrum, and that these distortions are present whenever that look like expansions in positive selection, and that they're present whenever the mutation rate is larger than the selective coefficient. Now, you know, at this point, we're sort of able to go back to this original picture and try to refine this intuition that we had. And try to see where we went wrong. You know, we started by assuming that, you know, only these mutation-free individuals have descendants, and this is true, but only in the long run. They're the only ones that are able to fix in the population. And you know, instead, what we found is that essentially all individuals can have like a large number of descendants in the short run, and thereby reach substantial frequencies. And so this has led us to believe that diversity should look like that of a neutral population with a smaller effective size, and this is true, but only in a limited part of this frequency spectrum. And in other parts, sort of fundamentally non-neutral behaviors arise. Sort of the easiest of which to understand is this sweep-like signature. And so, you know, apart from site frequency spectra, this has sort of also given us an ability to to learn more about sort of both like the past and the future of a mutation given its observation frequency. So what we've found is that basically the ancestral background fitness is informative of the frequency that you're likely to be seen at, and the opposite way around too, and also that the effects of background selection will depend on sample size. All right. So, yep.
Some more questions. So, for this, for the sweep effect, you need basically to for the neutral thing to fix in the zero class.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And so that fixation probably depends on the size of that class.
Yeah.
So, what kind of? You also already mentioned that you have large populations over. Total thing is large, but how large is your zero class?
Yeah, so the large, okay, so if the size of the whole population is n, the zero class is just equal to n e to the minus u over s. And so if you think about, you know, all individuals within the zero class are selectively neutral, and so you know, the probability of fixation, given that you arise, you know, in the zero class, is just equal to 1 over the size of the zero class, which is just 1 over the size of the size
so
of the
I mean,
zero
I'm
class.
Just thinking, like, in bacterial populations, uh-huh. Like, have you measured, like, have you, I don't know, estimated U and S, and, I mean, N is like, you know, whatever, 100 million?
I mean, ultimately, this will if you think about it, okay. So the probability of fixation within the zero class is the answer is, I guess your question is no. But why?
Well, I'm just wondering how, like, in what the regime, because you were. In what regime this starts to be
mm-hmm. important,
so yeah. to speak. And I'm thinking, you know, with in microbes,
mm-hmm.
you tend to have large populations, mm-hmm. at least in the experiments. Mm-hmm. I don't know about nature, but in the experiments you mm-hmm. have large populations. And then, you know, it's a matter of estimating U and S to mm-hmm. at least get a ballpark figure for this.
That's right. I mean, I think, so I think you know, the concise answer is really whenever negative selection is this is the sort of thing that should emerge directly from site frequency spectra. So, you know, whenever you have a reduction in diversity, it should be followed by these distortions. And so in principle, it essentially.
I think the fly example you showed at the beginning is a good one.
Yeah.
Right. If you look at the centers of chromosomes, they have a big distortion in diversity, and so you would predict.
Yeah.
That there's a distortion.
Yeah. I think it's a little bit confusing. I mean, even flies, I'm not sure are a good. Even bacteria, I'm not sure are a good model for these. You know, I mean, I think the asexual model is an important building block that sort of tells us how to think about these things. But at the same time, you know, if you look at any sort of empirical bacterial population, they're recombining. Usually you have horizontal gene transfer events that happen at such a high rate that I'm not sure that they're sort of substantively different than flies. But basically, you know, at this point, what people believe is, you know, for the kinds of parameters that are known to be relevant in flies, and also for the kinds of parameters that are relevant in that people believe might be relevant in humans, basically these distortions in diversity need to be these kinds of reductions can't happen.
So how would it look like if you relax your assumption that none of the deleterious ones becomes fixed?
So basically, you know, what starts happening is, you know, what guarantees that none of the deleterious mutations, or that these deleterious mutations fix rarely compared to the neutral ones, is this this condition that ns e to the minus u over s is much larger than 1. If you think about what is happening in the site frequency spectrum, basically, you know, I said that there was this you have this rapid decline up until 1 over n to the e minus u over s, and then you have this rapid this non-monotonicity that sort of arises from once you flip, so you go to 1 minus this frequency, and basically as this parameter is becoming smaller and smaller, and as you're increasing the rate at which these deleterious mutations are likely to fix, basically what happens is that these two regimes end up merging, and so from that point on you end up getting say frequency spectra that look like this, and this is sort of seen, you know, the class of models that describe these site frequency spectra is the Bolthausen Simon coalescence. So like a lot of the assumptions that we have made will end up breaking down as sort of a different class of models as necessary.
So let's say I gave you 1,000 genomes, mm-hmm. and then you could measure the site frequency spectra across the genome. It seems like based on this, you should be able to predict which of those genomes are the high fitness class. On the association between the tail of the distribution and their individual genomes, is that true?
This fitness is sort of it's a fictitious parameter that doesn't really tell you. I mean, what you could do is
don't you expect those genotypes that are out on whatever the tail of your distribution to be?
Yeah. So if you had 1,000 genomes and basically you saw that that some mutations were present in such large frequencies that they're very likely to be above this within this non-monotonic regime, then what you could say is those genomes that do not have those mutations are likely to be lower fitness. But basically, at this point, you know, when this mutation is at such a high frequency, basically it's distributed, like the reason it's at such a high frequency is that because it's distributed among so many different individuals of so many different fitnesses. It's linked to many different things. And so your best guess is, you know, for this purple mutation to be an individual of for any of these individuals, your best guess is this is an individual of average fitness. Whereas for these ones that don't have this high frequency polymorphism, caveat, assuming that you know that an oracle told you that this model is true. Wolfram?
So I think when you explained the different regimes, mm-hmm. and I was also interested in why it went basically up to the Plec curve, yeah. to the real. So on the yeah. left side, I think I understand it, mm-hmm. because everybody contributes. Yeah. Right, but on the right side, I'm still missing the understanding
there's
why
a
it goes
simple,
not only go up, but to
there's
the,
a simple, the curve. There's a simple explanation for that. Basically, the idea is, this is the black curve, and this is the site frequency spectrum. Okay. And so, you know, so in this regime, the argument for why they were neutral, you know, below this frequency 1 over n sigma, where basically this is the standard deviation in fitness, essentially everyone is behaving essentially neutrally. And sort of, you know, in the opposite side, there's sort of an opposite drift barrier, where drift is stronger for essentially whatever your distribution is. And if you think about it, so what this means is that, you know, in this regime, sort of if you look at the time-dependent trajectories, they're neutral in detail. So because they're just governed by drift. And now if you think about it, at steady state, the number of mutations that enters the population needs to be the number of mutations that exits the population, right? And so the total number of mutations that enters this regime also needs to be equal to the total number over here. And because their trajectories are sort of explicitly neutral, this is what, you know, it's like the amount of time times the number of mutations, which is what your frequency spectrum should be proportional to. And in that case, that needs to agree. Both of these things need to agree with the whole population. Prediction.
So if you had a different basic model, not a right Fisher model, where, you know, like a continuous time model where you take one at a time, yeah, would that give you the same?
Yes. I mean, you would need to rescale time, and there might be order one differences because, you know, depending on how you define your model, the variance in a neutral, the variance in the neutral offspring numbers for a neutral individual, the variance in offspring numbers might be different, but basically the differences would sort of be in substantive. Yeah.
Well, I guess I'm just trying to understand slightly bigger picture. So, you know, you explain things sort of nicely by comparing to the neutral model here, and like you're effectively saying that the excess of rare alleles is really the depletion
of the common ones, or intermediate ones.
But you also told us that, of course, so property of spectrum 1 over the frequency, more or less, and non-multiplicity is a much more general property, and you know, shows up in the selection, and people asking about recombination. So the same thing will show up in model with recombination as a result of draft, and in a way, so the only thing that doesn't show up there is that intermediate regime,
flatness,
which actually looks like neutral with reduced population size. But in practice, what exactly does one gain from going back to this effective population size?
Okay.
You know, of course, in this particular case, effective population size makes a lot of sense. It's the top bin is special, the top bin is neutral.
Yeah.
But this isn't, right, somehow, I think many of you know that, you know, I really hate this ineffective notion.
Yeah.
And but the only appealing thing about ineffective is one can imagine that it is so general and so useful, right?
Yeah. No. So
you virtually demonstrate that.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's the least general aspect of the problem that you solve happens to be explained by ineffective. So
I mean, I have to. Okay. So I think, okay, so I have two answers to that question. You know, one is I really want to highlight that I do not believe, you know, if I have ever said effective population size over the course of this talk, I do not ever believe that, you know, even this least general aspects of it, you know, in detail, you might think it's an effect, you know, it's sort of fluctuating effectively, but I mean, in even that least detailed, least generalizable aspect, you know, the effective population size intuition is almost certainly always wrong in these models of selection. Basically, you know, if you take it too seriously in any point over here, you will not get it right. I think the bigger picture question for, you know, what the, if I understand you correctly, you know, what is the point of like analyzing the time dependent behavior of a model that
I think these
issues of non-identifiability of site frequency spectra are actually really important to appreciate. And I think what this kind of time dependent analysis teaches us is actually, you know, So let me go back to my first slide. You know, we started out with this, you know, slight frequency spectrum where, you know, okay, so the slight frequency spectrum over here, sort of, but it's both functionally unidentifiable from any other model, but also sort of in, if you had full time series, in this case, sort of you would see something that is increasing in frequency as if it was positively selected. But I think that an interesting thing that this highlights is actually this is not true. So over here, so a simple exponential expansion and this model of background selection, they're unidentifiable based on sight frequency spectra. But actually, if you look at time-dependent statistics, basically time-dependent statistics will be identifiable. So if you have a single sample, you have a slight frequency spectrum, you really don't know which model is true. But if you had two samples, basically you can say a lot more. So imagine that, you know, so what I'm showing you over here, simulated data, you have sort of the original frequency of a mutation, and then some specified time later, this is sort of an ancient frequency in an ancient sample, and some specified time later, you sample and you look at the same mutation in the new sample. And so what you find out is that basically below a critical frequency, you expect, you know, these guys are just neutral because they're, with caveats, because their statistics are sort of neutral in detail with caveats. These, you know, if anything was present at these frequencies, this is unidentifiable. But over here, in this case, basically, in a model in which you have an expanding population, these 1 over f squared ones are precisely the ones that will be frozen. And so you don't expect them, they cannot change in frequency due to drift. Whereas over here, they're all in deleterious backgrounds, and so what you see is that basically in the next time point, you expect all of them to go down. And so if you look at sort of the proportion, so essentially, actually not all of them are going down, you know, the majority will. And so, you know, the overwhelming majority of these will no longer be polymorphic. A few, and sort of this also hints at the fundamental non-neutrality of the process. You know, if the question is, did it go up or did it go down, you should always say it's no longer polymorphic. But if it did go up, then it will have gone to a very high frequency, which is why you end up, which is why this doesn't go back down all the way to minus one. So I think this sort of points at, okay, so, you know, which statistics are not distinguishable and which actually might be. All right. Yeah. Well, thank you.